Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and on to changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, leadership coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is Teresa Torres, an internationally acclaimed author, speaker, and coach. She teaches a structured and sustainable approach to continuous discovery. It helps product teams infuse their daily product decisions with customer input. She's coached hundreds of teams at companies of all sizes, from early stage startups to global enterprises in a variety of industries. She has taught over 7,000 product people discovery skills through the Product Talk Academy. She's the author of the book Continuous Discovery Habits and blogs at producttalk.org. Teresa, welcome to Power of 10.
Andy, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So a lot of people know you, the 7,000 people at least. Your name at least comes up quite often in my work, in my coaching. People talk about it. You say, oh, do you know this book? I'm interested to know people's journeys from where they started to where they are now, because partly it's always interesting. I think it's also useful when people sort of see an author or they see someone who's kind of well-known speaker and so forth. It kind of feels unattainable. So I think it's also useful to hear from people, how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, I'm going to start all the way back to college because that's really where this journey started. As an undergraduate at Stanford, I was a symbolic systems major, which is a cognitive science program that draws from philosophy, psychology, linguistics, computer science. And so it's this amazing interdisciplinary program where I had to pick a concentration. My concentration was human-centered design. And that was sort of where I got introduced to the design world and this idea of include the customer in the design process. Design with people, not just for people. And I, as a 22-year-old, entered the workforce thinking that's how business worked. And then I spent the next 14 years as a full-time employee, severely disappointed that that wasn't how business worked. And I'm pretty stubborn, so I just stubbornly tried to make business work that way. And so in my full-time employee career, I worked as a front-end software developer in my earliest days because very few people were hiring designers at that point. I also did design work in those roles. Eventually, so I kind of started as a front-end software engineer slash designer, and then eventually became a designer slash product manager, and then eventually moved into leadership roles. And I ran product and design teams. I was a CEO of somebody else's startup, which I don't really recommend. And then eventually decided that I just saw the same problem everywhere. And that's that most product people, whether you're product managers, designers, or software engineers, just weren't spending enough time with their customers. And as a result, they were building the wrong things. And so after I think my fourth really early stage startup, I just kind of got burnt out and started to look at how can I be more effective than trying to change one little company at a time? And then that's what led to my coaching business, which evolved over time into a course business and eventually the book.
So can I ask, how long ago was it that you had that kind of moment of feeling disappointed?
It started as a 22-year-old. I remember my very first job. The first company that I worked at was called Highwire Press. We were one of the earliest providers of STEM journals online. So today, the big dog in that space is Elsevier. And Elsevier owns their own journals. So there's all these other journals that, like Science, Nature, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, all these really big name journals. They didn't have an internal organization to bring their content online, so they partnered with Highwire Press. And so that was my very first job out of school. It was a classic client vendor shop, right? They were kind of a professional services shop. There was no product managers there. There were no designers. There was one graphic designer there when I started. And there was a whole bunch of software engineers that were just like, we partnered with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and our remit was put science online. And I was blown away because what I saw over and over again was we just said yes to whatever these societies asked for. And there wasn't a lot of product thinking. And I didn't even know product thinking was a thing at the time. I just knew that we should care about their end users. And that wasn't showing up anywhere in the process. It really was a classic. We still see this, right? A company's customers hire the company to basically do professional services for them rather than this product mindset of, we're building a platform that allows us to bring journals online. And to be fair to Highwire Press, they did build a platform to bring journals online. They ended up publishing over, I think, 3,000 journals, and they did build a really good product, but it was very client-driven rather than sort of market product-driven. And I was blown away by that. I was like, wow, shouldn't we be talking to our end users? Isn't that, that's what I just learned in school. Isn't that how the world works? And then I saw that everywhere I went and was just kind of disappointed by it.
So the reason why I asked about the, you know, when was that, was I was kind of looking to work out sort of the era. I know it outs you sort of age-wise. So when are we talking here, date-wise?
Ah, late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So no, that's okay. Because the whole sort of product thing, that's not that old really, or the thinking of sort of product thinking. And we're going to have a conversation probably about this in a minute. Because you know from me, I kind of rant on about the services versus product thing. But, you know, it's more recent, I would say. What would you say, 10, 15 years? I mean, mine, the product has been going since when?
I would say it depends, right? So I would say broadly, it's become a topic that most people are talking about only in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
I would say some of the best companies, we can push back 15 years.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, arguably, I would say this started beginning with the Agile Manifesto, which really was looking backwards, right? When by the time the Agile Manifesto was written, it was looking at problems from the 90s and the maybe even before that.
Yeah.
But the Agile Manifesto was like step zero. I'm not even sure that got us to product thinking. It just got us to talk to your customer a little more often.
You know, I think from a design perspective, I always had this kind of thing with the Agile Manifesto, which was, oh, this is developers thinking in the way designers have always thought, you know, in terms of that kind of iterative approach and all those kinds of things, and rather having, you know, and actually sort of discovering what the problem is before you even start building something. That felt to me a very kind of designy approach. So it was always kind of weird for me to see sort of Agile then be sort of pushed on to design, because I felt like, no, hang on, we're already here.
Yeah.
The reason why I was asking you about the date thing is because I was thinking about this question. I was thinking, I can't ask this. It's really offensive, which was kind of along the lines of, what, you know, why does this book need to exist? And then I realized that the actual question is, because it's really good, your book, and I didn't want to say it like that. The less offensive version is, why do the problems that you tackle in this book still exist? Because as we've just talked about, these problems have been around for a while. And there's a bit of me that kind of feels like, you know, we know this, right? We know that you should go and speak to your customers and understand what their needs are, and then that should flow into how you're deciding what you should be building. Why is this still a problem?
Because humans are involved, I think, is the short of it.
Okay.
I mean, some of us know this, right? Like, I think people with a design background and trained in, not, I can't even say a design background, because I meet a lot of designers that don't talk to customers.
Yeah.
Right? I think people with a human-centered design background, where they were taught to include the customer as part of the design process, get this. But if we widen our lens and we look at companies and we look at the history of business and the evolution of business over the last 100 years, I don't think this is obvious, right? If we go all the way back to the beginning of the 1900s, how we won at business was being more efficient, right?
Yeah,
it was about building things faster. That has nothing to do with the customer. That has to do with manufacturing and production and sort of industrial age winning at this sort of productivity piece.
Yeah.
By the time we get to the mid-1900s, we start to see a conversation around strategy and markets and your position in the market. That gets a little closer to being customer-centric, but it's not customer-centric. Like, there's nothing customer-centric about Porter and his strategy framework. Mintzberg, another big strategy guy, gets a little bit closer when he talks about emergent strategy and listening to your market. But we're still not really customer-centric, even by the mid-1900s. And I think it really took the internet and the rapid pace of evolution and the dramatic increase of competition for business to start, I don't even think we fully recognized it, to start recognizing that really the biggest competitive differentiator is a better understanding of your customer. And I think we're swimming upstream against 100 years of history. We still see a lot of companies stuck in Taylorism and that sort of efficiency and productivity. A lot of companies still struggle with Porter. Like, a lot of companies still struggle with what in the world is strategy, let alone this next evolution of like, okay, we're actually designing for somebody.
It seems like such a no-brainer though, doesn't it? To you go and speak to your customers and understand what they want and then try and design products and services that meet those needs. I've had this conversation many, many times when, you know, there's a lot of frameworks out there. Some of them are kind of super complex. And what I really liked about your book is it's very clear. And I particularly like the anti-patterns, which I think was a very smart way of, so for those of you who haven't read it, you should. But, well, maybe you want to describe what the anti-patterns are and sort of how you came to the anti-patterns. And we'll start there.
Yeah. So fortunately, when I wrote this book, I had already been coaching, using all of the material in the book for years. In fact, I tried to write the book in 2016 and I realized, how do I know this content is going to work very well? I'm kind of developing it as I write the book. That felt very uncomfortable to me. I'm a very test and iterate kind of person. And so what I did was I started putting more of a formal curriculum behind my coaching so that I could test the content. And so where the anti-patterns came from, basically each chapter is about a habit that I want to see teams develop to help them build this strong feedback loop between the decisions they're making and their customers. And then because I had worked with a lot of teams trying to put those habits into practice, I saw where they went off the rails. And so every chapter ends with some anti-patterns. Here's some common things that people get wrong, and here's why you should avoid them. I think that's really important because it sounds really simple, like, oh, just go talk to your customers. And I really wish it was as simple as like, seriously, just go talk to your customers. But what we see in practice is that people ask the wrong questions.
Yeah, okay.
They frame things in a way that they want their customer to say great things about them. They don't want their customer to criticize their babies, which is their beautiful, perfect ideas, right? And so there's a little bit more nuance to this. And so one of my goals in the book was to help people overcome some of those mistakes so that hopefully we get to a world where we just make better products.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a piece I wrote about organizational amnesia, and my sort of thesis in it was this idea that, well, it came from me being asked sort of 2 to 4 years later to do exactly the same work with a client, different stakeholders, but the same business all over again. And I was thinking, you know, well, what's going on here? You know, there's some kind of amnesia. And of course, what happens is people get frustrated by the organization they're in. And the organization doesn't, you know, wants the change and digital transformation or whatever it is. But then they, the entire sort of infrastructure of the organization sort of structurally gets in the way of that. And people leave, or people, you know, stakeholders move on. And then they sort of come back around again. And one of the kind of things I was talking about was this idea of sort of cultures of doing, and actually about habits, which was, you know, like languages or craft skills, if they're not valued and people stop doing them, they just kind of die out. And that's how I felt like you sort of get this amnesia in organizations. And so for me, the anti-patterns were a really good sort of canaries in the coal mine in some respects to say, you know, if you're seeing these things going on, then you're starting to kind of slip back into the kind of bad old habits. But they're also, I thought, were really good examples of what not to do. Because I think most of, you know, many books you read tell you the kind of utopian ideal. And it's not really like that.
Yeah, I think for me, it was really important that the book be grounded in practice.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think we have plenty of books that talk about why we should be human-centered and why we should be customer-centric. Like, we've had those books, like you said, why is this still a problem in business?
Yeah, yeah.
We've had those books for decades. I don't think people know how to translate that into action. So one of my goals with the book was to help people literally translate it into action. And one of the things I'm most proud of is I do hear from teams all the time that say it's literally sitting on their desk as a reference, which is great, because that was the vision I started with, is how do I create a handbook that can act as a reference for product teams?
Yeah, it's very good on that front. And I've been reading your book and Melissa Perry's The Build Trap sort of in tandem, and then sort of recommending it to kind of everyone at the moment. You know, and I think it's because they're both very practical, and they sort of come at it in some respects from different ends, right? I guess Melissa's is looking at the CPO or the kind of product manager, and you're looking at kind of what could teams be doing, more or less. Is that fair to say? Or do you, yeah?
Yeah, I think Melissa does a phenomenal job of sort of getting into the day-to-day nuts and bolts of the messiness of being a product manager. It's like one of the most undefined roles ever. And I almost look at it as like, that's your, for a product manager, that's your foundation. But a giant chunk of your job is to learn how to cross-functionally collaborate with your team so that you're making better decisions about what to build. And that's where I see my book fits in.
Yeah, absolutely. So I said we'd sort of maybe return to the product service thing. On Slack, you see me kind of bang on about this. It's my kind of hobby horse. One of the things that I kind of feel is, you know, we were talking about the industrial age thing. We're talking about how that's kind of flown into business even today, even in the kind of world we're in. It's all about kind of treating the business as a machine and being this kind of ever more efficient. And then once you've kind of hit there and there's sort of parity across competitors, it's then, you know, went to all about marketing. And now we're in this different stage. You know, one of the arguments I often make, and I guess I'm saying it to you because I want you to kind of poke holes in it really, is that from a perspective of services, of thinking of, you know, the shift that we've made from products to services, that almost every digital product is actually really a service, right? It's got multiple touch points, it's an ecosystem. And that one of the dangers I find in using the language around products, it harks back to that kind of industrial era kind of mental model, which is, you know, an assembly line where you're building products. And so you see that thing where you have, you know, feature teams working on different parts of the same touch point, which itself is one touch point in a kind of larger ecosystem. And then there seems to be an awful lot of, because it's kind of thought of that way, there's an awful lot of work going on to try and kind of connect that all back up again. And yet you could have kind of started with that connected view in the first place, which is these are services. You talked about platforms before. I wonder what your kind of view is of that, and whether I'm just kind of saying, you know, get off my lawn, or whether there's, you know, I'd just be interested in your kind of opinion on that kind of perspective.
I think the idea of like product thinking versus service thinking, I think in a lot of ways, like I get the argument for why services gets you to think broader than just the product, which I think is really good. I think the challenge is most companies don't think they're creating services. And there's some baggage with that, right?
Yeah,
okay, we talk about professional services companies that don't scale in the same way that product companies do. So I think conceptually, the idea of service design is looking at all the touch points with the customer, the whole ecosystem. I think all of that is spot on. To me, it feels a little bit like the same way I feel about the jobs to be done language. It's really hard language for people to adopt. People understand they're building products. I actually like that product thinking is now becoming a part of the vernacular, because I think we can grow product thinking to mean all of that. I think one of the challenges with the product thinking language is that we tend to think it's what product managers do. Whereas I think product managers, designers, software engineers, anybody involved in building a digital product is part of product thinking. I'm not convinced service design is the right words. I think it brings up too much of this professional services. It's a little too foreign for a lot of companies that think about it as we make products.
That's fair enough. I've lost count of the amount of times I've had to try and explain it. And in fact, you know, the best way to explain it is either by an example or to work backwards and talk about the outcomes, you know, and then go back to that ecosystem view.
I think it's really important we not get caught up in the language. I'm not suggesting language doesn't matter. I have a linguistics background. Language definitely matters. But it's really easy to get into these like pedantic arguments about, is it like, I remember late 90s, early 2000s, it was about little D design and big D design and information architecture. Like it's, nobody cares but us, right? And I feel like this distinction a little bit falls there. Like I saw today, somebody pushed back on how I was defining discovery, because they define discovery as starting with an idea. And I define discovery as starting with a customer. And maybe historically discovery started with an idea, but I don't think that's true. I think Marty Kagan popularized discovery, and he defined it, the term itself, and he defined it as how we make decisions about what we build. And I think we should include the customer and the problem space in how we make decisions about what to build. But here's the deal. I kind of wanted to respond, and I didn't, because I don't want to have those pedantic arguments. Like, language evolves, right? Mm. Like, I think what's really important is that we match our language to what our customers are using. This is part of that customer-centric thing. Like, why are we teaching them all new language?
Mm. Wait, sorry, who are the customers in this? Are you talking about our clients as consultants, or are you talking about their end customers?
Well, if like as an industry, people are starting to adopt this product language, and that's what's organically happening, I don't think that we should be swimming upstream against that, saying, no, this is the proper language for it, right?
Yeah, it's not so much for me, it's not so much the words. I've just written a piece about this I'm going to kind of send out in a day or two as for part of my newsletter. It's more about, you know, there's this famous phrase by a rabbi who said, you know, words create worlds.
Yeah.
And there's this idea of kind of, you know, the language you use really does make a difference. And it includes and excludes, you know, if you think of, you know, illegal immigrant versus asylum seeker, right? Or, you know, all of those kinds of things, you know, boy or girl. And what if I'm neither, right? And all of those kinds of things. You know, it's important. And we see it, you know, right now, we see how there's a real push to kind of shift language, because language does set kind of mindsets. And hence sort of my thinking about this is, you know, how much are you creating a problem through the language that you're then actually trying to undo through the process and you know, like some of the stuff you're working on. You know, whereas if we'd started from a different kind of place. And I don't really mean in terms of disciplines and stuff. I'm the same with you. I think, you know, everyone is designing. If you're designing products that are part of an ecosystem, for me, you're in the business of designing services, right?
Yeah.
And the same goes in the other direction.
So I think this is part of that argument of language evolves. Like, I think language should evolve, and we should introduce new terms to help people grasp new concepts. I think the key is that the new terms have to be close to what is understood. Like, in order for people to adopt them and for it to expand thinking, they have to be close to what they know today. Right. So I think discovery and delivery is a really great example of this.
Yeah.
It was not a big reach for people to go from product to product discovery and product delivery. Like, that was adjacent to what they were already familiar with. And I think it's right why they're taking hold.
Yeah.
Whereas I think some people take it too far and they try to introduce this whole new term. In fact, I feel like I'm responsible for popularizing opportunities. I didn't create that word. It was already out there and existing. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish I hadn't popularized it because I think it is a little too different. I think I could have used customer needs, right? I was trying to get away from problem because we do more than solve problems. Yeah. But that's fine. It's out there. People are becoming more comfortable with it. But I recognize it's jargon that creates a barrier. And I don't want to be a part of that. I want to stay as close to the vernacular people are already using and then try to introduce language that expands that thinking.
Nudge it around. So, let's talk about opportunities, actually, because, you know, I think this is one of the, your opportunity tree is probably the one of the things you're, you know, well known for. But the idea of not just kind of going off on all, you know, in all directions and actually evaluating opportunities rather than just kind of needs, I think there is a bit of a difference between those two. And what do you think it is?
Yeah, so I do like the term opportunity. I will say that I do think it's a good term. I like that it's slowly getting traction. So I didn't make up this word. I feel like it was already being used in the industry, but it was being used by designers. And I think the reason why it was introduced was that we used to talk about the problem space and the solution space. We see lots of products that don't solve problems. The examples that I always give is I really like ice cream. It probably creates more problems than it solves for me. But it is a viable product, right? So how do we represent that in this concept of the problem space? So I started to think about, like, across a wide variety of products, what are they doing? They're addressing needs. They're reducing pain points. They're addressing desires. So ice cream kind of falls into that desire category. Like, I want something that tastes delicious. Some things that taste delicious solve problems for me. They provide nutrients. Other things that address that desire create problems. So I can't really put them in the problem category. People really understand this problem space, solution space distinction. I mean, it's a little challenging, but they can wrap their head around it. Thinking about the opportunity space versus the solution space is a little bit of a harder jump, but I think it's an important one. So this is one where I'm happy that people are starting to embrace it, because I think what I see is most people jump straight to a solution. And we even see this, like the Lean Startup, fantastic book, but it really starts with an idea.
Yeah.
Whereas I think good teams don't start with an idea. They start with a customer. And they start with an understanding of the opportunity space.
I agree. I think that's kind of idea. I think it's maybe it's partly designer training, actually, I think, which is, oh, here's a problem. I've got an idea how to solve that. You know, and literally, if you are one or you live with a designer, you'll know that's kind of, they're really irritating people to walk around with, because you're constantly kind of going, why is that like that? It could be like that. And why has they done this? And whereas, yeah, I agree, opportunity space kind of makes it broader in your sort of framing of it. And I think it sort of slows down the jump to, you know, solution. Talking of which, you know, talking of slowing down, you know, part of what you're doing, or part of what you talk about a few times in the book is that, you know, I want to slow you down in this bit, even if it's just for a little. Tell me a little bit about why you think that's necessary.
Mostly because of cognitive biases. So a lot of what I like to do in the book is design frameworks or tools or activities to help you see your own thinking. A big theme throughout the book is to externalize your thinking so that you can then see and examine it. This is really at the heart of critical thinking, right? So a good critical thinker takes the time to evaluate. So I have this belief. What led to that belief? So what were the precedents that led to that belief? And equally important, what are the consequences of this belief, right? That's what a good critical thinker does, is they understand all the inferences that led to that belief and the following inferences that result in consequences. We don't get trained in this, right? Like, I never took a class that taught me, hey, to be a good critical thinker, you need to examine what led to your beliefs and then examine the consequences. I learned this from reading John Dewey's really hard book, How We Think. But it's phenomenal. Like, when you think about it, like, that makes sense. Okay, so then if you have a basic understanding of cognitive biases, our brains make really fast inferences. And sometimes those fast inferences are wrong because of cognitive biases. So what I like to see teams do is, if you can externalize your thinking and start to externalize those precepts and then those subsequent consequences, you can catch those mistakes. And I think this is particularly true for product people, because it's easy to fall in love with an idea, and our brain is making a fast inference from either an outcome or a customer problem all the way to a solution. And we're not really examining, does that actually solve that problem? More importantly, was that the right problem to be solving? Is it going to impact our outcome and create value for our business? So a lot of it is just, how do we get people to slow down, externalize that thinking, And then I really want to do it in a way without you having to know that that's critical thinking, because
or that these are the
cognitive biases, right? Because most people don't really want to geek out on critical thinking or cognitive biases, like maybe at a surface level.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
The world would be a bit better.
So
if people did.
I try to ground it into the work that we have to do, right? Like just follow these methods, it'll help you overcome biases.
You know, it's one of the biggest challenges I think that teams face, right? Which is this pressure for velocity, right? And quite often I'll ask, you know, why does this have to be done so fast? And, you know, why can't you take another week? And there is no real answer, it's just that they're told to. And, you know, and some of it ripples up to being sort of VC-funded startup, but some of these aren't startups. And sometimes it's just de facto faster is better. And it does feel like there's this real need to at least slow down in the beginning so you're running in the right direction later, you know, because if you sprint in the wrong direction, you quickly end up in the wrong place. Right?
Yeah, I think some of this harkens back to these ideas of the industrial age. Faster is better, right? And we see that show up in feature factories. We have teams that are just, this is the whole idea of Melissa's book, is avoiding this build trap,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Teams think about more output is better. That's a manufacturing mindset.
Yeah.
And that's true if you already have a widget that you know people want to buy, and more widgets mean more revenue. But in a digital product world, more features does not mean more revenue. And so that's, it's a little bit of, we got to break this culture of more is better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you end up with Word from kind of like 1999 or whenever it was, where there was just so many palettes and features, you know. When I think of kind of physical products, though, I think some of the best products that we know of, and the products, the physical products that people kind of love, they've had like so much stripped away, and actually sort of taking stuff away seems to be something that is very hard for product teams to kind of get their heads around. I mean, we've been talking so far about kind of what should we be doing and in some respects what you should be adding. What about taking stuff away? What should we remove?
Yeah, I actually like to describe this in the context of the opportunity space. So like, let's take the alarm clock. This is a classic example where alarm clocks just got so complicated over time because we added more and more features. If we think about this in the opportunity space, we have a lot of needs. Like really the primary need of an alarm clock is I need to wake up on time, right? But we added additional needs. Like I would like to wake up to something more pleasant than a beep. And I would like to know what time it is. And I would like to have a white noise machine to help me fall asleep. And I would like to, and so we've identified, there's all these sort of needs that sort of grew around alarm clocks. And as alarm clocks started addressing all those adjacent needs, the core need of I need to wake up on time got diluted. And so what happens is we partially solved a lot of opportunities, but we didn't fully solve any of them. And I think the best products limit the number of opportunities they solve, and they fully address them. And this is partly why I want to see teams map out the opportunity space and not move on to the next opportunity until they've fully addressed a small opportunity. Because I personally believe you'll build a way better product if you fully address a smaller set of opportunities than if you partially address a big set of opportunities. The problem with that mindset is that how people buy things is different from how people use things. And in the purchase decision, they want to see all those features, but when they're actually using it, all of those features actually interfere. And so until we start to figure out how to bridge that sort of marketing versus using gap, this is going to be a problem.
I was going to say that's kind of a byproduct of marketing, you know, because, and I think that's how I mentioned Microsoft Word, you know, but quite a lot of things are equally, I could point at Adobe as well whilst I'm at it, which is, you know, it's like the marketing team, like, so what new stuff have we got this year that we can market? Right? And that's what they get caught in that cycle. And you can't say, we've taken this thing away. The only company that the only thing I can think of where a company did that, and, you know, it wasn't painless, was when Apple kind of rebuilt the iWork suite and they kind of stripped it kind of right back and then kind of gradually started adding stuff in. But there was a lot that kind of went away.
I mean, I would love to see marketing teams also become customer centric. Yeah, right now, they're very product centric, right? They talk about what we built. I would love to see them shift to, here's the success our customers had with this product. Right?
Yeah.
That, I think, is when marketing will shift away from this feature factory mindset.
But let's talk about outcomes over outputs.
Sure.
What's the difference?
Yeah. So again, this is really grounded in that feature factory industrial age mindset, right? Where we've historically asked teams, produce all these outputs, build these things. And what we're starting to recognize, mostly because of the pace of change in the world, is that we can't predict right now what we should build 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And actually, I think this is the silver lining of going through a global pandemic, is if you started January 2020 with a fixed roadmap, it probably changed by March of 2020, right? Yeah. And so what we're recognizing is, okay, if we can't predict the future because everything changes so quickly, let's take a step back and say, why are we building these outputs? What's the impact we expect these outputs to have? How are we measuring that impact? And that gets us to an outcome. And then that allows us to say, it's not about building these outputs. It's about having this impact measured by this outcome. So let's just start with the outcome and iterate our way through to figuring out how to reach that outcome. That allows us to react and be adaptable to change. It allows us to test and experiment. It gets us away from building too much and more about how do we build the least amount of stuff that has the impact we need.
Which is also an advantage of starting with that idea of opportunities, right? Because needs to features seem to be a kind of one-to-one quite often, I think, whereas opportunities kind of force you to focus somewhat as well. So you've been coaching for a very long time and the book has grown out of the coaching, but you know, coaching itself is a voyage of continuous discovery. So now having published the book, and you've probably had quite a lot of feedback on it by now as well, what are the bits that you know, after the print deadline you wish, oh, now I'd like to put that in, you know, because things change fast, right?
Yeah. So there's some little things one of the things I tried to do in the book was there's a million ways to test assumptions. And I see teams really rapidly get overwhelmed by that. So I tried to distill it to like, here's some easy tactics. There's three in the book. I've already added a fourth. So I actually probably will put out a revision to that chapter. And what's great about self-publishing is I can release that revision whenever I want. And it doesn't have to be a full-on second edition.
Yeah.
So that's like a really short-term tweak that I probably will make in the next month or two. Longer term, the big gap that I see in the book is that I really wish that I had dived deeper into ethical assumptions. So there's a whole chapter on how do you identify the assumptions that your ideas are based upon.
Yeah, yeah.
I did introduce ethical assumptions as a category, and I framed it as, you know, what data are you collecting? How are you using it? Who are you selling it to? How are you storing it? We see this show up a lot in data breaches and companies asking for way more information than they actually need. And then I also framed it as sort of social equity and inclusivity issues. And that second category has blown up. We see a lot of teams talking about, again, thanks to 2020, how do we do that? Like, how do we be more inclusive in the way that we build products? And I wrote the book throughout 2020, and that's been a topic I've been thinking about for a long time, but I really want to dive deeper. I think teams are hungry and eager to do that. They just don't know how. That probably won't be a revision on the book. That will probably be I don't know if it'll be a whole second book or if it'll be a workbook that complements this book. It's too early for me to tell, but I'm definitely diving deeper on how can teams surface ethical assumptions that will help their products be more inclusive and help us not replicate the inequities we see in our societies and the products that we're building.
Yeah. I don't know if you know Sarah Becher-Walter's book, Technically Wrong, and she sort of goes into this quite a lot.
Oh, I don't.
Oh, you should. You should definitely read it.
Yeah, cool.
And, you know, and I can't remember when she published it a couple of years ago. It was just sort of just before Facebook, you know, the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal kind of broke with Facebook. And then, you know, since then, it seems like the sort of tech industry has been unraveling in that regard quite a lot. And I would argue it's very, very hard to think about, because ethics is difficult, right? Ethics is tangly and messy and there are no right answers. And I think designers sometimes come at it as a bit of, well, we're doing the wrong or the right thing. But often it's incredibly contextual, as the age-old trolley car kind of problem sort of demonstrates. And it takes some thinking through. And not only that, it takes a dedicated team of people to try and kind of nefariously break, you know, to red team something, to really kind of nefariously kind of try and bend and break and think, how would someone abuse this product? How would someone use it completely differently to how we think? And, you know, and that's my favorite thing to do to my poor students is to kind of do that with their service concepts. But it's really, really valuable. It sort of runs counter in a way, I think, or it has up until now been connected to this problem of velocity, because if you're going really fast, you sort of don't, well, as it's cognitive bias as well, you don't give enough time to think about these things, you know, and with data is perhaps also equivalent to the speed thing that, you know, more speed or faster is good and more data is always better was generally the kind of mantra. Now we're seeing that kind of unravels. It's very hard to undo it after the fact. Once you've captured a load of data and you've kind of positioned in some cases your business model around that, it's very, very hard to walk that backwards. And I am expecting that some organizations will probably fall over as a result.
Yeah, I don't. Okay, so I don't think it's possible that a product team can foresee all of the unintended consequences of how their product will be used. I just don't think that's possible.
No.
But
they're unintended for a reason, right?
We can do more than we're doing now.
Yeah.
Right? So like you said, we can have red teams that sort of try to beat this up. I think more importantly, we are making implicit decisions about who we're going to serve. No product can serve everybody equally well. And I think the challenge right now is a lot of those decisions are implicit instead of explicit. And so we get things like medical devices that work for people that have fair skin and not for people with darker skin.
Yeah.
I don't think that was an intended racist consequence, but the outcome is racist, right? And so how do we ask better questions? So we just reduce the times that happens. I don't know that we can get it to zero, but I do think it's our responsibility to ask better questions so that we catch more of those instances.
Look, I completely agree. I think that unintended consequences are by definition unintended, but I think you can have some sense of at least thinking through how might this be used wrongly. You can never catch every case, but the effort to at least do so, it feels to me like it should be a fundamental part. Because let's square the circle to kind of round back to the beginning, if you were talking about physical products, like there are things that some of these things you wouldn't be allowed on the market because you'd know they are kind of dangerous. There's got some bare wiring in it, or it's got sharp corners that people cut themselves. It feels to me it's like that level of kind of basic duty of care that kind of doesn't happen. Partly because I think in the digital world it's so ephemeral. And as you're saying about your book, well, we can kind of fix it afterwards. But then it mounts up, and you get like a. Maybe it's ethical debt that kind of builds up over time, because it's one small thing you think, oh, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. And then they aggregate to something that really does matter.
I think this is a really important piece. So we can't always foresee all the unintended consequences, but when we start to get evidence of the unintended consequences, we can be a lot quicker to act on them. So you brought up Cambridge Analytics. That was what, 5 years ago?
Something like that. Yeah.
Right. So it's 5 years later. What has Facebook done? Okay, they did a couple things. They limited how much data goes to third parties, but they're still letting companies abuse that data through their advertising program on their platform. And I actually like Facebook advertising. I think they've built a really unique advertising product that has a lot of power, that helps empower small businesses and gives them a platform to compete with big businesses. So I don't think that all of Facebook is evil. But I do think that they have more responsibility than they're acting on right now, and that they didn't learn the lessons of Cambridge Analytics, not fully, and that they do have more responsibility to curb some of this unintended consequences that is clearly emerging on their platform.
Yeah.
And they've been really slow to act. And we see this across the industry. Amazon has a lot of the same problems. We see that they have unintended consequences of counterfeit products, and they've been aware of it for years, and it's still a problem, and it's still there. And I don't think there's easy answers here, right? Like, I don't know what the solutions are, but we certainly can be doing more.
This is what I mean by the sort of ethical debt idea, which is, it's very, very hard. Once you've got to that scale, it's very, very hard to kind of then unpick it, And there was a thing recently where, I can't remember who it was, but someone from Facebook said, we've got the largest amount of the content moderators or something like that in the world working at our organization to take off. Disinformation, but they've got an even larger, aka the rest of the company, group of people where the business model is really predicated on the opposite direction. And then it's impossible for that group of moderators to really do anything about it. And it sort of comes back to this idea that, everyone is designing this. You can't have one group of people in the corner trying to kind of fix the ethics whilst the rest of the company is doing the opposite. And you just see it over and over and over in different industries. We're coming up to time. I feel like this is something we could kind of talk about for a very long time. At the very least, I think there's something there that is important, a message, which is to take the time to study your thinking and actually do some critical thinking before you touch any kind of design work at all. And that seems like a good kind of place to end. Now, listen, people can be coached by you. People can obviously read your stuff. They can also do your classes and courses online. So where do people find you online?
Yeah, so the first thing is the book is called Continuous Discovery Habits. A lot of designers in particular, because I know you have a big design audience, ask me, how is discovery different from design? Discovery obviously draws a ton from the design world. Here's the key difference. Discovery is a team sport. A designer should not be going off on their own, being the voice of the customer and bringing it back to the team. And the reason for that is it's hard to truly cross-functionally collaborate when one person is the voice of the customer. That's a trump card,
yeah.
Right? So we really want it to be a team activity. So for designers listening, I really encourage you to read the book. I'm sure there's things that you can take from it and really help be an advocate for this team mindset in your organization. There's a couple other resources I'll share. Along with the book, we did launch a membership community where people can connect with like-minded peers, ask questions, get feedback. We do mini coaching sessions. We do community calls. It's super fun. You can learn about that at members.producttalk.org. And then we do have a variety of online courses that help you develop skill in each of the habits. So we have a course on interviewing. We have a course on defining outcomes. We have a course on opportunity mapping. You can learn about those at learn.producttalk.org. And if that's too many URLs, you can just go to producttalk.org and you'll find all of it there.
I'll put them all in the show notes anyway. Now, one of the things I always ask every guest at the end, because the podcast is named after the Rand Charles Eames film called Powers of 10, which is all about the sort of relative size of things in the universe. And I'm always interested to hear what one small thing people think either has already kind of changed the world and people don't know about it, or would change the world and have a huge impact if only we did something about it.
Oh, that's a big question. You know, I really think that we are just at the beginning of understanding what it means to be a customer-centric business. I think in our business culture, we're still hyper-focused on shareholder value, on profit. I do personally believe a business needs to have a profit. That's what's going to earn you the right to serve your customer over time. But we need to elevate serving a customer at the same level. And it's not a new idea. Peter Drucker talked about this, but we're not living it today. And it's such a simple idea, but I do think it would radically change the world we live in. And I think it would dramatically decrease things like income inequality. I think work would be a much more civil place. I think people would be excited to show up and go to work every day instead of experiencing burnout. So even though it seems obvious to you and I do think it's a small idea that has a huge impact.
That's a fantastic way to end. Teresa, thanks so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
Thanks so much for having me.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullain. You can find me at apullain on Twitter or pullain.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.